Hello and welcome to episode 34 of Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life. My name is, as usual, Marcus Freestone. And this week I thought I would offer up something a little bit different. We could all do with some welcome entertaining distractions during the current world situation. And so I present you an episode containing absolutely no mention whatsoever of the C word. See what I've done there? Yes. So this is a reading of one of my short stories, which is really quite insane and odd, but I think it will, well, it will certainly distract you for the time that you listen to it. Whether it's an enjoyable distraction or not, I don't know, but I can promise you that while you're listening to this, you will not be thinking about the C word. So this is a short story of mine, taken from an old comedy podcast from a few years ago. This is Ethelbert's Sunday Afternoon. Enjoy the distraction. Ethelbert's Sunday Morning. Ethelbert was past 90, but had never really picked direction in life, or a gender. He, she had undergone so many sex change operations that he, she couldn't even remember which way they'd started out. Therefore, Ethelbert now compromised. A typical daily wardrobe consisted of black trousers and lilac jumper, cream skirt and football shirt, all leg warmers and a lumberjack shirt. A wispy beard was ever present. But being 90, that was kind of inevitable. Time was spent veering randomly between woodwork and knitting, Top Gear and Loose Women, The Sweeney and Murder, She Wrote, Andy McNab and Barbara Cartland. Two cats shared the house, one male, one female. There was a vague memory of having been married once or twice, but to what or whom was unclear. Having the first name Ethelbert was unfortunate enough, but such were the vicissitudes of having been born in 1920 that Ethelbert Gaylord had been cursed on both fronts. All 36 cats over the years had been called Leslie to simplify matters, and to use up the job lot of engraved collars Ethelbert had purchased during a drunken afternoon in Brighton in 1951. Recollections of the exact reason for this fortuitous purchase had gone for good now, but Ethelbert was still occasionally plagued by random memories of a small shop that only sold pet collars, envelopes, and surgical trusses. That would explain why Ethelbert had written 4,000 letters during 1952, but not why they had all been addressed to Lord Mountbatten, and all contained a vociferous complaint about the terrible toilet facilities on Hampstead Heath. Ethelbert cleared away the breakfast things, having, on principle, eaten a sumptuous fried breakfast every single morning since the day they abandoned rationing. Once again, it would be a running battle between clogged arteries and flatulence, but the flatulence would probably win again today, and Ethelbert would live to fry another day. The two Leslies ate a far healthier breakfast of smoked kippers and exhibited far less flatulence. The kitchen was unchanged since the day in 1943 that Ethelbert and Leslies 1 and 2 had moved into the house. The smell of washing up liquid and gin mingled with the dense cigar smoke that swirled around the room.
The cats were very lucky to be at ground level, with only the smell of damp slippers and mothballs to distract them from their opulent daily diet. Indeed, bearing in mind the amount of cigar smoke, fried bacon meets burnt saucepan smoke, and the occasional gin spill ending up in their water bowl, it was surprising that the average lifespan of all 34 previous Leslies was 19. This meant that, at their peak, there were 17 Leslies resident at once. That was when Ethelbert bought the trunk. Colin yawned expansively and looked at his watch, but the hands had stopped. So had the feet. The decision to buy a watch that was also an 18-inch scale model of Arthur Mullard was one he had seldom regretted during the last 17 years. But he had to now admit that, as the battery had run out 8 years ago, it may be time to invest in a more practical timepiece. Nevertheless, he estimated that about 7 hours had passed, so it was probably safe to come out from under the kitchen table. Gingerly and pedantically, he stood up, banging his head on the kitchen table. "Thatcher!" he exclaimed, which was the generic, all-purpose swear word he now employed in all situations, since an unfortunate episode in a Basingstoke crematorium in 1987 had forced him to forego all foul language. Pressing himself to the wall, he crept inexorably and tangentially towards the hallway. He knew that possible evil lurked in the hallway, or that evil possibly lurked in the hallway, or that possibly lurking in the hallway was some evil. But there's a limit to how long you can play count the kitchen chairs, and Colin had reached that limit after 3 hours. He didn't have any kitchen chairs. He ate breakfast standing up to avoid the onset of piles. He also ate breakfast by pouring alternate mouthfuls of cornflakes and milk into his mouth to avoid wear and tear on crockery and save on washing up liquid. Colin saved up all the money he would otherwise have spent on washing up liquid in a special jar. Once a month he used the money to treat himself to a new ball bearing. Colin had lots of special jars. In fact, he had a special room in which to keep all his special jars in. One of the jars contained 228 ball bearings. Another contained a wrapping from a pork pie he'd particularly enjoyed in Budley Salterton in March 1992. Another contained the condom which had aided him in losing his virginity in 1983, along with a variety of as yet unidentified life forms and a primitive prototype for some sort of farming implement. Next to this jar was one containing his mother's ashes and the spleen of an old school friend, which Colin arranged next to each other to illustrate the juxtaposition between life, death, and having your spleen removed with a spatula by a defrocked archdeacon. Passing by his special room, Colin couldn't help noting with satisfaction that the hand-engraved sign reading Colin's Special Room, No Trespassers, Hawkers or Anthropologists was glinting nicely in the sun. It had definitely been worth the effort in moving his kitchen 3 feet to the left in order to allow the sun to properly penetrate the hallway. Colin settled in front of the television and took out his snooker audience bingo card. There was no prize because it was a game of his own devising that only one other person in the world was allowed to play. As this was a World Championship quarter-final, it should be plain sailing, although he and his competitor had each chosen one of the day's matches to watch on the red button by rolling a dice, so a full house was highly unlikely. Over the next half hour, Colin enthusiastically ticked off many familiar faces. The dice had been kind to him today. There was the bloke who looks a bit like the bloke who used to be Nigel in EastEnders, the woman who dresses like a mare, the woman who sits next to the woman who dresses like a mare, the bloke who looks like Richie Benno would have looked in 1978 if he'd been a pub landlord in Caerphilly, the bloke who looks like he's wearing a wig from an Absolutely sketch, the bloke who looks like Darren Goff but confusingly wears football shirts, the nice-looking woman with the glasses, the bloke with Kenneth Kendall's nose, Peter Wingard's eyebrows, William Woolard's teeth, Brian Cant's elbows, Terry Scott's knees, Jenny Agutter's toes, and Felicity Kendall's handkerchief. The bloke with the tie who looks like he's about to spontaneously combust. The bloke who looks like the actor Nicholas Grace. The bloke who looks like Stuart Hall. The bloke who doesn't look like Tony Wilson. During the mid-session interval, Colin made himself an extra strong cup of tea to celebrate his success. It was only then that he noticed an opal fruit pile-up in his kitchen cupboard. This required immediate attention. Colin had formed a habit of going for an afternoon walk every day since July 1991. However, he did not take any water with him due to the total lack of public toilets within a 5-mile radius of his house. It was therefore his penchant to partake of opal fruits to quench his thirst during these perambulations. He removed the 5 packets of Starburst from the cupboard, crossing himself as he did so, conducted the ceremonial burning and flushing of the wrappers, and set to work replacing them with his own facsimile of the original wrapping emblazoned with the correct nomenclature. He also did this with Marathons and Jif. After the daily ritual of a video episode of Murder, She Wrote, Ethelbert went out to the garden. It was a generous plot of land with an enormous bordering hedge that obscured all but the roof of the house from view from the road. This was probably a good thing, considering some of the things that had happened in the garden over the years. Ethelbert ensured that this was the exact spot requiring weeding before kneeling down. Although very sprightly for 95, it would nevertheless take a while to get down and then back up again, so precision was the order of the day. Okay, it wasn't exactly weeding per se, just digging, but it involved the same cranking up of motor cortex and knee joints. The garden didn't really need weeding, but Leslie had been looking a bit peaky over breakfast, so preparations had to be made. Normally, of course, Leslie would be embalmed and go in the trunk in the attic with all the previous Leslies, but after 38 years, the trunk was now packed to capacity. Indeed, Ethelbert had been mildly perturbed upon closing the trunk on Leslie number 34 when, due to the unexpectedly springy nature of 33 other embalmed cats, Leslie number 34 had half popped out of the trunk, causing 2 paws to be chopped off when the lid was closed. As always on these occasions, Ethelbert fell to pondering her own mortality. Despite years of assiduous research, it appeared that self-embalming was physically impossible. Who could Ethelbert possibly trust to do the job properly? Cremation was not an option, because Ethelbert's body contained so many steel pins and other paraphernalia that the casket would in all probability explode like a faulty firework. After preparing a suitably feline-sized hole, the idea of Sunday lunch suddenly popped into Ethelbert's mind, like an MP popping into a bush on Hampstead Heath. A tedious leftward shuffling motion eventually brought into proximity the cabbage patch. As the digging progressed, Ethelbert was momentarily startled to strike something hard. Just a stone, probably, but no, this object was far too big for that. As more earth was moved aside, it revealed a thigh bone and three fingers. From the general size and condition of the bones, Ethelbert estimated that they had lain there for about 50 years and belonged to a man of roughly 6'2" with a penchant for cravats, pickled onions and snooker. "Of course," exclaimed Ethelbert, "it's Terry. I can't remember putting him there." With a shrug, Ethelbert began to cover the bones and look for a better spot for Leslie number 36. It would be inconvenient for 36 to go before 35 because it spoiled the pattern, but so be it. Patting down the earth, Ethelbert experienced a few dislocated memories of Terry in a church with a top hat and a flower in his buttonhole, but their significance remained elusive. An hour later, and the cabbage was steaming away horribly. Nobody in the house liked cabbage at all, but Ethelbert tried to eat something green at least once a week. It was a penance of a sort, but it would take several million cabbages to wipe out all the sins committed in the house and garden since 1943. Elevenses meant homemade cake and Darjeeling for Ethelbert, pepper army and milk for Leslie and Leslie. The cats settled down by the fire and went to sleep. Ethelbert switched on Granada men and motors. Colin slid along the hallway like a hamster on Boxing Day. In other words, with a sense of increasing terror and a small buzzing sound in his right knee. He used his ninja training to approach the porch with the required stealthiness. When he was sure the coast was next to the sea, he quickly opened the door and retrieved the evil piece of small card from the special things that come in through the letterbox collection device mat he had knitted from the embalmed remains of a family dog. "I thought so," he grimaced as he read the words written in language on the card. "You could save yourself money by switching your oxygen supply to us." He threw the card into his special disinfecting evil waste basket and went to wash his hands 14 times. Putting on his balaclava and blonde wig, Colin went out to the back garden to feed his pet hedgehog, Dinsdale. It was costing him rather a lot these days, as Dinsdale was now 800 yards long. He'd struck it lucky this week, though, when he'd had the good fortune to accidentally run over 17 cows while test driving a steamroller. That would see Dinsdale through to the weekend, and all it had cost Colin was the price of the sesame seed baps and gherkins, without which, for some reason, Dinsdale would refuse any meal and kick off big time, which is something Colin always tried to avoid when dealing with 800-yard-long hedgehogs. Going back inside the house, Colin removed the balaclava and wig he always wore in the back garden to confuse the watching MI5 operatives into thinking that there were in fact two people living in the house. He had conducted this charade for 17 years, ever since returning from Budley Salterton. There was nothing to do with the pork pie. It was an exhausting charade to have kept up for 17 years, but Colin was confident that it would soon pay dividends and give him precious seconds in which to destroy the evidence when MI5 finally raided the house. From tuning into their radio broadcasts, he knew that it would be weeks rather than months, so he was already planning his escape. Indeed, the tunnel was nearly finished. Colin looked at his shopping list as he waited for the coast to become clear. Picklesome skepticism, invalidator biscuit, counteract a magnetic field with Lego. Follow Nick Clegg around for a few days, shaking my head and muttering quietly to myself until he gets the message. Butter no parsnips. Hear no evil, but see loads of it. Amplify the concept of infinity until it becomes so huge it actually becomes really small, then try to sell it to Pakistan as an alternative test ground. Belatedly wave goodbye to a tryst. Marmite. Bin bags. Hedgehog toothpaste. Ten minutes passed fairly uneventfully. Then they completely stopped doing so. At first, it seemed as if the sound of the front door being battered down was coming from the episode of The Sweeney currently playing on the television. As the noise became louder, Leslie 36 woke up and looked around the room with an expression of mild interest. After a few seconds, the battering ram finally won the fight, and the door, which had withstood all manner of weather and other more painful stresses for 68 years, crashed to the floor, to be immediately trampled over by 8 men with machine guns. Four of them burst into the living room like overexcited puppies in a biscuit factory. The rest ran upstairs and began tearing apart the various bedrooms. "Nobody move!" screamed the first man to enter the room, pointing his gun at Ethelbert's head, while the other three searched the room and then trained their guns on the two cats watching languidly from the fireplace. Ethelbert impassively took another sip of tea and very slowly, with exaggerated effort, placed it down on the table before picking up the remote control and muting the sound on the television. "Good afternoon, gentlemen. Would you like some tea?"
"No, thank you,"
screamed the man with his gun trained on Ethelbert's head. "Cake? It's an old sponge recipe I picked up in Brighton in 1951. Ethelbert began the process of leaning forward to pick up the cake tray.
"Move away from the cake!"
"I'm afraid that would take up the greater part of an hour. Now then, what can I do for you, gentlemen?" Ethelbert's posture shifted imperceptibly, and a million thoughts began to jostle for priority. "I don't think that the cats are going to give you any problems, do you?"
"The three men..."
You had Leslie and Leslie in a pincer movement, shuffled nervously, and looked rather sheepishly at the other one.
"Go and help upstairs," he hissed at them.
As the men left the room, Ethelbert tried very hard not to break into a smile, and also to calculate how long it was since one of the men had opened her bedroom door. About 90 seconds. Time to concentrate. "So," said Ethelbert, drawing out the words deliberately slowly, with the timing perfection of a seasoned newsreader, "are you going to tell me why your friends are currently trampling their muddy boots all over my house and are disturbing my cats?" The line was timed to the millisecond. Just as the man's eyes flickered slightly, Ethelbert's spare wardrobe exploded, releasing plumes of CS gas and nicely distracting the one man left downstairs. With practiced efficiency, Ethelbert removed the Glock pistol from behind the sofa cushion and shot the man in the side of the head. Then, pausing to pat Leslie and Leslie reassuringly, the 95-year-old picked up the machine gun and crept slowly towards the living room door. Three sets of footsteps could be heard thumping downstairs, then three bodies fell in a heap at the bottom. Four down, four to go, thought Ethelbert, steadying the gun. Now, where did I put that spade? This is going to require a really big hole. Before commencifying the shopping operation, Colin had a couple of errands to run. "Excuse me?" "Yes, how can I help you, sir?" said the man with an air of heavy resignation. "This is the Tourist Information Centre?" asked Colin. "Yes, it is," said the man, glancing sideways at the massive sign proclaiming the booth's purpose. "Good," said Colin, "just checking. It always pays to be accurate in these matters. I once accidentally bought some crack when I thought I was in a shoe shop. That's 5 months I won't get back. Anyway, I'm looking for some information." "Regarding what?" "What I should do about my hedgehog." "That's not the sort of information we carry." "I'm a tourist. I demand that you inform me, or else I shall sue you under the Trades Contradictions Act." "That is a made-up act, sir."
"Like homosexuality?"
"No."
"Well, you say that, but have you ever actually seen a gay? I've heard they don't show up on film."
"That's vampires."
"What about gay vampires?"
"What about gay vampires?"
"Perhaps that's a double negative and they cancel each other out."
"What?"
"Perhaps you can photograph gay vampires, but not normal vampires or gay non-vampires."
"Normal vampires?"
"Yes, you know, the ones that don't perform acts of immoral anal-based behaviour on each other. Perhaps you can photograph them."
"Perhaps you can, sir. I, however, do not have a camera."
"That's very careless of you, my good man or boy. One never knows when the necessity may arise to photographically capture an incident involving a celebrity bumming in order that one may inform the authorities."
"I really will have to discontinue this transaction with the utmost haste.
Would you care to tell me why?"
"I don't care, but I'll tell you anyway. You've been coming here every day for the last 3 years, and I really must insist that you piss off and don't come back."
"Well done, you've passed the test. I shall immediately inform the squirrels that live under my bath. You could expect a visit from them in about 3,000 years.
Colin ticked the item off his list and then proceeded with the utmost haste towards the newsagents.
"Hello, newsagent-style servant. I'd like to buy a Mars bar, please."
"To eat? Well, all the chocolate bars are right there in front of you."
"Yes, I'm currently locating them via the method of refracting light through my eyes and optic nerves."
"So you're not completely stupid?"
"My stupidity has been officially measured by NASA and falls well within the safe levels outlined by the Safe Levels Outlining Committee. And now I begin my next sentence after this colon. I cannot see anywhere a sign stating clearly and rectangularly that they have been tested."
"I can assure you there is no listeria, salmonella, E. coli or anything else in our chocolate."
Yes, that much is beyond the horizon, and the pale, and my ken, and the Thunderdome. But have they been tested for drugs? Drugs? Thought the newsagent. This is a new one. What do you mean? He asked, hoping to expedite matters before the next ice age. Drugs, amphetamines, dope, crack. Well, sorry, I don't understand. Don't change the subject. Have they been tested? Tested for what? Muscle-building drugs. Have, in short trousers, your current stock of Mars bars been tested, thereby to ascertain whether they or whether they do or not indeed or in fact contain muscle-building drugs or not? Are you serious? No, you're the serious one and I'm the crazy wacky one. I'd have thought that was obvious. Geography. Don't change the subject. Have they been tested? Of course not. Why should they have been? To ascertain whether or whether not certain substances have or have whether or have not have been or haven't have not to have been. Yes, we've established that. I'm so pleased. Well, I'm not. Buy something now or leave my shop. Anyway, why would they contain stimulants? Athletes are always failing drug tests and a large number of athletes eat Mars bars. They must do, they keep saying so in the adverts. That's a very tenuous link. Thank you, my good man or woman. Look, will you, during the next 10 seconds before I hit you very hard in the knees and eject you from my shop like a Betamax videotape onto a beige carpet, be buying some bloody chocolate? Of course not. There are no drugs in them. What's the point? Because they taste nice? Yeah, and I eat pickled unicorns for breakfast. Disgraceful. Never darken my stools again. Colin stormed out, noting with satisfaction the MI5 operative lurking near the greeting cards with what he erroneously thought was a hidden video camera. After finishing his shopping, he perambulated over to the park for a relaxing lunch. Excuse me, he asked an unfortunate woman. Yes? Do you require the entirety of this bench in order to complete your culinary processes, or is there a section of it which I may use for my own masticatory purposes, heretofore the oral consumption of prepared sandwich-style sandwiches? The woman clutched her bag to her chest and shifted as far away as she could without actually falling off the other end of the bench. No, it's free. You mean they haven't introduced a congestion charge for benches yet? Excellent! They'll be charging us for breathing next, the crafty fascist bastards. Yes, I suppose so, mumbled the woman, trying to ignore him. Really? I was being facetious, but you actually think it's going to happen? I'm absolutely astonished. Is there a white paper in the offing? I really couldn't say. My God, have they made it subject to the Official Secrets Act? I can't believe the depths to which these scum will sink. Do you think we're being bugged now? Should I put a radio on to drown out our conversation? Perhaps we should communicate in code. I don't think that will be necessary, said the woman, finishing her sandwich as quickly as possible. Ah, of course, you've already checked the bushes for MI5 agents and listening devices. Quick thinking, sir. Yes, the last thing I want is for Special Prize to insert a mind-reading probe into my head and rummage through my memories. I still get headaches. Oh dear, muttered the woman. Thank you for the sympathy, my good sir, but the scar is almost healed now. It used to look like a map of Britain, but now it's shrunk to the size of Anglesey. These modern laser probes really are very efficient, even if they do bring back unwanted childhood memories about the cupboard under the stairs. I still get hiccups whenever I hear a dog whistle. I really have to go now, the woman almost shouted. Good idea, yes. I'll wait 5 minutes before leaving in case they follow us. Excellent idea. Please ensure that you do, said the woman, all but sprinting away. Right, said Colin. Orange alert. Orange alert. They won't catch me with my curtains down again.
Ethelbert managed to clean up most of the blood in time for Antiques Roadshow and a well-earned pint of gin. Leslie and Leslie had observed with their usual detachment as body after body
had been rolled down
the hill to the bottom of the garden. Having never seen a trunk in the attic, they obviously assumed that this would also be their final resting place and were beginning to wonder if there would be enough room. This time, Ethelbert had taken the precaution of trying out a new type of acid that had been bubbling away in the spare airing cupboard for a few months. If calculations were correct, it should render the men down to bones within a fortnight. After Antiques Roadshow, Ethelbert switched over to the snooker and began rummaging around for a fresh bingo card. It occurred to Colin that it had been 17 years since he'd last cleared out his loft, so he went up to have a look at his non-jar-bound archive. Putting on the light, he was pleasantly surprised to find only 6 items in the whole loft space. Obviously, all the others had either been eaten by mice or abducted by aliens, so he didn't have to worry about them. He assessed the 6 items in reverse order of his attachment to them. A life-size plasticine replica of Nicholas Parsons trying to pacify Kenneth Williams in a 1978 edition of Just a Minute. A non-life-sized model of the post office tower made from eyelashes, widgets, and frozen urine. A map showing the hidden location of Douglas Bader's legs. 163 photographs of Winston Churchill and Clement Attlee, both dressed as vicars, throwing buckets of fermenting cheese at some squirrels. A shit in a bottle. And finally, his favourite of all, a parody of the Bayeux tapestry made from retread tyres, burnt matches, and the hopes and dreams of 1,000 disillusioned poets, depicting the final of the 2005 World Snooker Championships, where Matthew Stevens lost to Sean Murphy by recklessly taking on a middle distance blue left-handed. Later that day, Colin was startled but not unprepared when the silent alarm mounted in his hallway began to flash bright red. Shouting a quick goodbye to Dinsdale, he drew up the drawbridge, armed the automatic gun turret, and hurried down into the tunnel to begin digging the final few feet that would lead him out onto Bodmin Moor. From there, he would catch a train to Exeter before passing through Ottery St Mary, Honiton, Yarcombe and Chard, before backtracking down to Lyme Regis, Seaton and Salcombe Regis on his way to the final location of Operation Doomsday. The following morning, Ethelbert was satisfied that the house would now pass all but the most rigorous inspection. The knock at the door was timed to the second, of course. "Hello, Colin," said Ethelbert. "It's been a while. How is Dinsdale?"